So hello again, and here we are back with the Beyond the 90 podcast, powered by One Shot Football. I'm your host, Steve McBain. We're here again in Singapore, and we've got a full lineup on the show today. We've got pod regular and heavyweight, Mr. Ryan Marsden. Ryan, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Hello, everyone.
And now, several weeks back, we broke into the 21st century and we had a first lady on the show. And since then, I've been getting a lot of stick from Io, who is he's basically the boss of One Shot Football and the editor. And he informed me that we had our highest ever ratings that week, so he said, get her back. And so we did. So, actress and voiceover artist Gazelle O'Harker, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me back. It's a pleasure to be here. That must be a fluke, the ratings being higher that week.
Well, that's what I told Io, but he insists otherwise. And but anyway, today we have another pod first. Now, we have obviously a big Premiership focus on the pod, but we've been trawling the masses for a real fan from a lower league provincial club, I should say. And we found one, Mr. Tom Moran. Tom, how are you?
Excellent, thank you very much. It's a bit harsh as an opening comment. I would say we were not that low.
Well, we like to set the tone, and I am a Chelsea fan, so. But Tom, now, as is traditional, when we have a new guest on the show, we like to ask them who they support and why.
Well, as we sort of alluded to there with your mockery of my wonderful beloved Fulham, it's a great club that I've supported ever since I was a boy. Used to be a season ticket holder down there at the wonderful stadium.
It is a great stadium.
Grade 2 listed. I think it's one
is
of
that
the
right?
Yes, quite
it's
a part of
the because it's by
stadium.
The river, right?
The actual cottage in the corner. And the whole stand along the side of Johnny Haynes.
We were just discussing that Michael Jackson statue. Is that part of the listing?
Michael Jackson statue even has gone. I've followed the club through some great times. Obviously, Europa League finalists with Super Roy Hodgson. A few years ago, it was very lucky. I still think to this day, if it had gone to penalties, we would have beat Atletico Madrid, which at the time had David De Gea in nets, Aguero and Forlan up front. So I think we did quite well to get beat just in extra time by my hero. I know we've had a lot of great players over the years. Best, George Best, for example.
Well, that takes us on to who is your favourite ever Fulham player?
I'm going to have to go with Clint Dempsey, just for the goal against
you. He's American!
Of all the players that Fulham have had, you go for a modern...
That one night at Craven Cottage against Juventus, in the semi-final second leg, with that chip that basically put us to the final. I mean, as a Fulham fan there, when we'd gone 1-0 down, at the beginning of that game, to go through was
wow,
brilliant.
There you go. It's a wow. Fulham special today. And your worst ever Fulham player?
Oh, too many to mention. shocking signings.
Mike Smalling,
no, cult hero. Although, again, we're a bit of a feeder club to Man United. Him, we resurrected Van der Sar when he went to United. Yeah. So I'll say that.
One of the oddest transfers I think I've ever seen that one. But in part one, I'm just going to look through the week's news. And we've had a week of Champions League performances. So Manchester let the country down badly. And Arsenal and Chelsea, some good results. Gazelle, are you hopeful of going to Greece and finishing the job off?
Yeah, well, initially, when we went into that game, we'd just been beaten by West Brom. And I was kind of hoping that we'd capitulate some more and then we wouldn't have to deal with Champions League at all, and we can just focus on the league. But we actually won, and we actually won very well.
Alexis Sanchez, excellent again.
And Ozil was outstanding. Ozil has had 11 assists and 3 goals to his name all season. It's really quite astonishing.
Most talented player in the division for me.
Yeah, he had a lot of stick when he first got to Arsenal, but yeah. Can we go to Olympiacos and win? Yeah, I think we can, because if we played like that against Zagreb, I don't really understand why we lost to them in the first place. And it would be really annoying if Bayern played for a draw.
David Spina, I think, is probably the main reason.
Yeah, they call him David Whoops Spina.
Ah. I think it's taken the English clubs a little bit of time to actually start taking the competition seriously. I think there's this whole, the Premiership is it. But Ryan, I mean, United left themselves a bit of a job.
They did. I'm not overly surprised. We've talked about this many times. It's their consistency. They hot and cold. This was a lukewarm. It wasn't a cold one. They performed. They dominated possession. Unfortunately, I didn't see it, so I had to go with the reading due to the time zone. But just couldn't put the ball in the net. That's no surprise this season. Not going to make life easy for ourselves this season, and I think you have to go and do the job. You know, if you've got to beat a Wolfsburg to deserve to be in the quarterfinals of the Champions League. So go out there, prove everyone wrong, and make some headlines.
The problem is that they all seem to be lining themselves up for second place finishes. I mean, Tom, I mean, Bastian Schweinsteiger said this week he wants a Champions League win at United. Having seen Bayern and, you know, and Barca this week, I mean, he's...
No English club really has a chance of doing probably past the last 16, maybe quarterfinals at best. Just to go back on the Wolfsburg point, I read this week that at the last 41 games at home Wolfsburg have played, they've only lost three.
Yeah.
So that's a huge, I think, mountain to climb for United and their sideways style of football.
The motivation is there. I mean, if they win, they come top of of that group. I mean, that's it. If you can't motivate yourselves with that as professional footballers,
Talking about Barcelona and Bayern, I had a great stat this week against Bayern Munich. So basically, Bayern Munich in the Bundesliga this year, if every shot on target against Bayern this season had gone in, where would Bayern Munich be in the division?
Still top of the league.
They'd still be top of the league. So basically, Manuel Neuer doesn't have a job. They don't need a goalkeeper. That's how good they are. But I mean, you know, again, you know, just talking about Bayern and Barca and these guys, I mean, Real Madrid got thumped in El Clasico. I mean, is there anything Rafa Benitez can do to close that gap, or are they just, they're just too good?
I would say, if you looked at that from that one, the Madrid, when he went out there, that was Benitez saying, right, you want all these superstars on the pitch. There they go. So they basically played with a 4-0-6 formation. And then to skip forward to the Champions League, he changed the pack, played the players he wanted to play. And apart from the last 10 minutes, where they shipped three goals, They were a very good side.
Quite a high risk strategy, that, I would suggest, getting thumped at home by Barca, to make your point. But I mean, I guess the point is, I mean, you know, you've got Benzema, Bale, Isco, obviously Ronaldo, and it just doesn't seem to be quite good enough. I mean, who you bring in to close the gap to these guys?
I think it's more to the manager. I mean, you know, I don't know him personally, but Benitez is not known for galvanising dressing rooms. It seems to be very polarising with the characters and the high net worth of the guys there who think they run the world inside that dressing room. You probably look at him and point and laugh as soon as he walks out the dressing room, to be honest.
There does seem to be a bit of a love in it at Barca as well.
That's the fundamental problem, and I don't think that can be resolved while he's still the manager.
An interesting point I heard is if you look at MSN, as it's now becoming called, Messi, Suarez and Neymar, does Ronaldo even get in the top three players in the world?
It is hard to sort of see him getting in there. Now, another place where there's some love going on is at Liverpool right now. They had a win last night against Bordeaux and had a quite stunning result at the Etihad at the weekend. I mean, some signs now that they're starting to understand Klopp's methods. I mean, they were all over Manchester City. It could have been six by half time.
I mean, if he's made his mark in three games, that's exceptionally impressive. Again, I think it's man management more than raw talent that he's extracted. And it just goes to show how important having the right manager is. I think we all agreed in this podcast that he was the right manager for Liverpool, probably the right manager for a few clubs, but this just proves the point. I mean, he's galvanised.
Trying to sign nine-year-olds, you were telling me as well?
No, he did a very revealing interview with a nine-year-old fan of Liverpool FC. It's really good. If you get a chance, check it out on YouTube. But I think Klopp has the ability to just get the team together. And Lovren was saying that the difference that he's experienced is that we play as a team now. We play as a collective. And that is something that Liverpool really needed. So, you know, they're not a collection of individuals. They're a team now, and they thrash City good.
Yeah, the gegenpressing, as I believe it's called, is the word. I mean, one standout player for me in that game, the change was Lallana. Uh-huh. His work rate off the ball compared to
he pressed,
when he was with Rodgers. The pace, the energy, the pressing, everything. He's already got more wins against the top four than Rodgers had in his whole career. So he's obviously doing something right.
Well, unfortunately, he's going to have to do it without Daniel Sturridge for the time being. He broke down injured again last night. But I think Liverpool's main competition for the top four will be Spurs. Spurs looking good as well. I mean, dismantled West Ham. you know, who've been you know, good away from home? Are they no longer Spursy? That's the question.
As much as it pains me to say this, Spurs are actually a really good side at the moment. As an Arsenal fan, I shouldn't really be saying that. But yeah, they really took it to us when we they drew with us 1-1, and towards the end of the game, we did look like we could have won that game. But actually, Spurs were really hot, and they were really pressing and driving the action, and we were lucky to get a draw, to be honest.
I guess the thing is whether they can keep this up for a whole season. You know, they are also playing this high pressing game, and they don't have a huge squad, and they have tended to fade a bit.
They're probably the most confident team at the moment in the division. They're playing with such confidence, and
considering they have Kyle Walker in their side, is impressive.
But Steve, as you point out, consistency has always been Tottenham's issue. Not even game to game. In recent seasons, it's been 20 minutes to 20 minutes. They can play some good football, but then just lose it and heads down lose a game. You know, it's quite. But that doesn't seem to be there this season. I have to, you know, hold my hands up there. I gave them a lot of stick at the beginning of the season, but that's because they were playing terrible at the beginning of the season. So to turn it around and be the consistent performers that they have been is quite impressive.
Well, one other model of consistency this season has been Jamie Vardy, who equaled Ruud van Nistelrooy's goal-scoring record and did it in one season, not across two. Even got a I got a tweet from the. From the horse-like Dutch centre-forward. I mean, he'll be going up against Manchester United to beat the record.
Well,
we will talk about that.
Yes.
Does anyone have him in their fantasy football team?
Yes.
How long ago did you get him in?
I resisted for a little while, but I think about five or six weeks ago now.
This is usually the one you put him in and then he breaks his leg or something.
Yeah, true. Because you're chasing last week's points and you shouldn't do that.
Yeah, he did say, though, this week, Vardy said he didn't know how he got through last weekend.
Yeah, how the physios
patched him up. So that could be. And if you look at for him as an individual, their next run of fixtures, maybe he's going to have.
They have got some.
Is he fit for the weekend?
He is fit. Yeah. At the moment, he's fit for this weekend, and obviously they've got United, and then the next four fixtures as well.
I think before the end of the year, they have Liverpool, Everton, Chelsea. It's Manchester City as well. They've got some tough games.
And it's the most congested part of the season. Yeah. Right? No time to recover.
Now, Gary Monk, he's under renewed pressure at Swansea. They had a poor result against Bournemouth, 2-0 down, and he left a host of his big names on the bench as well, which seemed a really odd decision given, you know, they didn't have any midweek football and they're under so much pressure. I mean, Tom, should he be given more time or...?
Definitely. I did read again today that the average of a Swansea manager is 20 months, so he's right around that time. However, though, a lot of their managers have been poached, you know, away from them, so they have been done. But one story I did hear was that he fell out with Hugh Jenkins.
About bringing in a director of football.
Yeah, perfectly, as you said, he's bringing in a director of football, and as he said, no. You can say that when you're winning, but obviously now, and as you rightly left out, he left out Montero, Sigurdsson on the bench at the weekend. They were 2-0 down at home to Bournemouth. Mm. There when they fought back for a Desmond.
I missed that. So Gary Monk requested a director of football.
No,
the other way around.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Good. Yeah, but they still fought back for 2-2. But you know, I think he's got to be given time. What he's done, you know, for that club is amazing. He's taken on the mantle of football that was put in place by, you know, Rodgers, Laudrup. Who else was there before?
Brendan Rodgers.
Rodgers as well, yeah. Rodgers, Laudrup, and whoever else has done that. They do play some amazing entertaining football.
I'd like to see him get a bit longer. But speaking of managers and time, seems to be an awfully long one trying to find a new manager at Fulham. What's going on there, Tom?
Well, you know, we did approach Steve Clarke at Reading, and he came and had a chat, and then there was a breakdown in talks. I'm not sure. Allegedly, it was to do with personal terms, although he said no, it wasn't to do with personal terms. I know that Clarke has had a lot of abuse going back to Reading, and but he said that Reading fans should be flattered.
Well, I think he said as well was that they were going to get full compensation, so yeah. he was doing it in their best interest.
Gary Rowett has been placed as a bookie's favourite and everybody's favourite.
I mean, it's presumably quite a nice job. I mean, you know, there's a good youth system there, academy. And
the youth system there is amazing. We've literally won the under-18s Barclays Premier League the last three seasons in a row, the under-21s FA Cup, we were finalists not so long ago. We have a very good academy where they've gone for good coaches rather than names. For example, you know, good ex-pros that have just retired, they've gone for good, well-established coaches. However, I do think it does have a little bit to do with the money that Fulham does have being well-backed, and there's no financial fair play in the youth system, right. So we can have a bit of influence on players in the London area, and we do have a very, very good. There's another Dembele just about to come through at Fulham, who's doing very, very well. So yeah, the youth system, is things are looking good there, but as tends to happen, you know, we'll probably end up selling them on once they become.
That's an economic, sensible economic thing, yeah. As a club.
And what's Fulham this season, what would you class as a successful season? Or,
well, I mean, looking at playoffs, obviously we had the crazy German there last end of the Premier League and into the start of the Championship, putting cheese on people's knees for injury ailments. Breda Hangeland's leg, he asked him to put some cheese on his thigh.
It did seem a slightly odd appointment.
Yeah, and there was, you know, stories of him making them just run and run and run before they even got anywhere near a ball. So by the time they actually touched a football in training, they were already physically exhausted. I'd like the playoffs. So I think from the position we're in now, if we can string some results together, you know, it's a very, very tight league, the Championship.
Very tough.
It's very fixture heavy as well, though. You know, it's sort of, in some ways, you know, you're playing Saturday, Wednesday, a lot of weeks of the season. So hopefully, yeah, playoffs would suit me. But the club's in a good position financially, so I can't, you know, we're not going to collapse, which is a good thing.
All right, okay. Well, that takes us to the end of part one, and we'll be back shortly with part two. And so here we are back with part two of the Beyond the 90 podcast. And as is traditional in part two, we're going to have a bit of a roundtable discussion. And what we're really going to look at today is tactics within football, and probably the lack of tactical nous that teams in the Premiership seem to be persisting with. I mean, if we look at Chelsea, my club this season, I still maintain that the biggest problem with Chelsea since Mourinho goes back is that he's fighting with a system that I almost think he feels he has to play, but he's not happy with. Arsenal are playing a similar system, and Manchester City, it's a 4-2-3-1, and it's being done without really the requisite players, either in the holding positions or a centre-forward that can really play in that lone role. Just looking around Europe at the moment, Juventus and some of the other Italian clubs are moving to a back three system. Bayern's system is so fluid and flexible, and even, you know, Barcelona now, you know, playing 4-3-3, a little bit more direct and really relying on a front three. We saw Real Madrid get taken to school by Barcelona playing a 4-2-3-1 with ill-equipped players. So, I mean, guys, is the Premiership always 5 years behind, looking at what people did before, not having the personnel, or what do we think is really happening here?
With the Premier League, and you hear from most pros, they say how physically demanding and how the tempo is a lot quicker. So I think in comparison to other leagues, you look at Italy, it has a tendency to be slow football. There's not so much physicality. The tempo is not as high. And then Spain, it's quite different, you know, altogether they play with a lot of different style. However, I think we shouldn't be too worried too much in some ways about some of the tactics. The Premier League, you know, is probably the most entertaining league in the world where anybody can beat everybody, which is probably better than if you look at La Liga. You know what your top two is going to be, you know who's going to win the Bundesliga, and roughly with Serie A, it's normally one from three, depending on what's happening and what money's exchanging hands.
Very true. And this season, the Premier League is the most open it's ever been.
So. It is, but I think that, you know, we were just discussing, about Bastian Schweinsteiger wanting to win a Champions League. I mean, the English clubs look so far off the pace. I mean, Manchester City, for instance, they played Juventus twice this year. Juventus have been terrible in Serie A, yet they've beaten them home and away. Manchester United are struggling. Arsenal have had, poor results. I don't think we could really see any of those teams. I mean, do we think one English team will even be a semi-finalist? Maybe if they get the right draw?
They would have to get the right draw to go through, and a bit of luck. But when you're talking about the tactics and the way they play, I think you've got to roll it all the way back to the youth. the youth system, how kids are taught to play in these days. When I learned to play, I was playing 11 a side on 11 full-size adult pitches when I was young. You have so much time and space on the ball. You know, it needs to be the European way of playing football, definitely.
I think tactics, I mean, they have a lot to do with, very much everything to do with squads, but if you look at teams that are trying to rebuild, it makes finding the right tactics very difficult. A team that's established, and I'm probably starting to look at a Man City now because they've had a pretty much the same base of players. Chelsea as well should be established. Their tactics, their formation should be set in stone, and they should be really maximising that, making it most efficient. Man United, for example, you know, there are three number 10s, you know, and how to make that fit. It's a lot to do with squads. Maybe it's to do with the fact that the European teams have more stable squads. They don't have quite as much money to play with. And that squad stability and learning over a season or three what the best formation is the key. It's just that stability. When there's chopping and changing, new managers, new this, new players.
Okay, but I mean, let's look at, for instance, Manchester City this season, who I think most people, well, not most people, but some would certainly argue have got the strongest first 11 in the league. They've got a team that is pretty well bedded down. They added quality this summer with Sterling and De Bruyne, but you know they've had a manager there for a few seasons now as well. I've seen them be ripped apart twice by Spurs and Liverpool. So tactically, they're obviously struggling there. Arsenal consistently struggle in Europe, and Chelsea, I mean, have just been an absolute basket case tactically this year. They've been a complete mess. And then you look at, you know, how functional and organised, you know, someone like Bayern Munich. And I was just looking at the Bayern Munich, you know, formation. They almost play this sort of, you know, 4-1-5, but they have the players to do it.
Exactly.
So I don't know whether it's a combination of tactics and players, or whether, you know, for instance, at Barcelona, I think that Barcelona have got away with a huge amount over the last half a dozen years because of Sergio Busquets, he's such an underrated player. He's probably, I would argue, the single most influential player in Europe because he allows everybody else to do their thing without the fuss. Now, obviously, he doesn't have the talent of a Messi or whatever. But at the same time, also, if you have a Messi, Suarez, and Neymar, you could probably play any formation you like. You could, you know, you're going to score so many goals anyway. But I mean, are Premiership clubs really just trying to mimic these teams? Or do they actually have their own ideas, or are they just followers?
No, because we don't really have the squad depth in terms, or the necessary players to change around the formations as frequently as the European sides.
Well, why not? I mean, they've got all the money. I mean, you know, I'm an Arsenal. I mean,
it's the quality of competition as well. You know, as pointed out by Tom, if you're playing 75% of the other teams in your division, you can settle and, you know, over 90 minutes, you're going to win 2-0, 3-1, whatever it may be.
Well, Bayern, I would argue, I would accept that a little bit with Bayern.
Obviously, I'm looking at the top, I'm comparing the top teams here. And the nature of the Premier League, the fact that maybe other teams, when you know, your opponents have better plan Bs than you. I mean, you know, every game is an FA Cup final when you play a Man City, you know, Arsenal, Man United, maybe less so this season. But maybe it's not the plan A that's easier, it's the plan B. Do the European teams have a better plan B?
I mean, for instance,
do they switch their tactics halfway through the game? I don't watch enough European football.
Yeah, that is certainly the case because, you know, like Arsenal are well known for just playing attacking football, and we don't tend to adapt to who we're playing with. Whoever our opponents are, we're always playing attacking football. And
in, or sulking.
Very true. But then in recent games, we have had to mix it up a bit where we were up against Bayern and it was a must-win game and we had to just sit back and allow them to have the possession and play on the counter. And that was something that's maturing in this Arsenal squad now. But then this issue with the formation is that we have to play 4-2-3-1 because we don't have the players to play 4-4-2. Like there was talk at the beginning, why don't we play at the beginning of this season, why don't we play Walcott and Giroud together? Well, that would mean that we'd sacrifice Ozil or Ramsey or one of our other playmakers, and that's not going to happen. We can't have Ozil on the bench.
But you know, you've seen the creative managers do switch formation. You know, if the 4-2-3-1 sure, whatever you want to play isn't working, then they switch.
But you could turn that on your head and say, well, then the manager has been buying in players to fit this 4-2-3-1.
Yeah, well, Arsene Wenger would also say that he's only buying players who are of top quality, who are available at any given time. It's not as if you can just go and find a top-class striker.
Wenger's two best teams have been 4-4-2s.
Very true. But then Walcott and Giroud, could they actually really play together? Because they're very different players.
Well, you'd need Walcott to be fit. But,
true.
But it's just the problem as well, you were saying about the tactics. I mean, and it's not just an English problem. I mean, let's take Van Gaal the other night against PSV. I mean, you're saying about plan B. So United are struggling to break down PSV, you know, who are quite well organised at the back. So what does he do? He brings on Marion Fellaini to hoof the ball up to and leaves Juan Mata
on the bench,
who is, you know, one of the best number 10s, you know, around, and doesn't bother trying to put him on. That one for me...
He also allows Rooney to do whatever he wants because they're not putting it. You see how far Rooney drops back. The other night against PSV, Rooney ended up, he was basically next to Schweinsteiger. So he's dropping all the way back to a holding midfield role to try and influence the game. But I understand maybe his legs are going because he's played a lot of football. But if he's still up the top, that's where he can make most of the influence.
Well, that's the Rooney of old as well. When he had a free role, he was everywhere. So I'm pleased to see that, but it's definitely an act of desperation, not an act of organisation.
Does Van Gaal actually know who his best 11 are?
Oh, this is the question.
Well, he barely knows the names, but but is this maybe what we're maybe trying to get to, is that in the Premiership we're very, very focused on who the person is? And, you know, I remember when Ericsson was the England manager, there was a lot of criticism that the players were untouchable. I mean, Rooney's untouchable. You're saying you couldn't have Özil on the bench. But yet you look at Real Madrid after that terrible result against Bayern, they went to Shakhtar and they did leave some of the names on the bench, and, you know, okay, they had a crazy last 10 minutes. But I mean, are we too focused on this guy's a superstar, this is how much he earns, and so therefore this guy has to play?
But it's also about confidence, because if they're playing well, you can't put them on the bench. It's like this dilemma this week about whether or not Sanchez should have ended up being subbed when we had the game locked up at Zagreb, at home to Zagreb. He doesn't like a rest, is what
he's particularly well. Wenger had quoted as saying he gets tired if
a break makes him tired.
He also apparently as well on his walk during training, if he misses a shot that he thinks he should score, he has an extra lap to his warm down.
Because it's the psychological element of if the player is playing well and they're in high confidence, then why take them off to fit the formation of the team that they're playing against?
I look at Manchester City, for instance, who have David Silva and Yaya Toure. Now, if you're going to play a 4-2-3-1, that means that Yaya either has to play very, very deep in a holding role, which he just, I don't think, is suited to, or you lose a lot of the, you know, the benefits of playing him. Then if you play him at number 10, it means you have to push David Silva one side or the other, and then you lose, you know, arguably the best number 10 in the league, along with, you know, with Özil. So again, they just seem to be shoehorning people into this formation. We must play this way.
Look at the managers you're discussing here. You're discussing the managers that probably should retire if they were normal working.
Yeah, but I mean, look, right? Mourinho's...
Are they too old?
Mourinho's persistent with Fabregas in a deep role. That's not working.
Isn't Fabregas mostly on the bench?
Well, he's been playing again the last couple of weeks. I think most Chelsea fans would agree he probably is his best position at the moment. But
I guess the point I'm trying to make is the managers are accountable for the tactics and the formation. Are they not as up-to-date and as modern as the game is? The game has evolved so much. Maybe it's the managers themselves that need to evolve.
Why are they all fixed on 4-2-3-1?
I think it's just because the trend is counter-attacking football. So everybody wants to see fast counter-attacking football. So to facilitate that in some ways is 4-2-3-1. Invite the other team on with that formation, then you can bomb on and then you create the gaps.
That's why the league's so open, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what it comes in cycles, though. I'm sure if we were to have this conversation in 4 or 5 years' time, we'd be back to 4-4-2.
Where's the innovation with the managers?
Well, that's what I'm saying. They all seem to be following. They're always... I mean, you look at these formations that...
Is it Klopp doing it?
The Bayern, the Barca, and these guys are playing, and they're very, very different, you know, in terms of the personnel, and also how the personnel understand the positions. I mean, you watch someone like, you know, Philip Lahm, who's... nominally, not nominally, but you know, was a right back. But you watch him play that holding role, how well he understands it, how well he knows what he's meant to do. You watch Busquets, you know, Xabi Alonso. I mean, one of the best comments I think I ever heard from a footballer was Xabi Alonso a couple of seasons ago. And they were asking him, they said, what is wrong, you know, with English football? Why, you know, is the national team so bad and the whole thing? And he basically said, whilst there is still an opinion in English football that tackling is a skill to be applauded, he said, you'll never get anywhere. He was contending that tackling is something that you only have to do if you're out of position. So basically it's like something of last resort, yet, you know, the crowds all around, you know, England, you know, go mad every time there's a big thumping tackle. He's basically saying you're out of position. You should have intercepted the ball, or you know, the pass should have been blocked.
That's interesting.
But you know, you just look at the appreciation of the tactics, and I just don't know whether the players really understand what they're doing. But the managers are not, you know, this is not, you know, Neil Warnock managing these clubs. This is meant to be sophisticated, you know, well, continental
you almost see more innovation with the younger generation, the 30, 40 something managers, and that's what's going to keep them on the toes. It's going to be crazy, but if you change your formation three or four times in a match, you would completely bamboozle the opposition. Now, whether it can practically be done is a different matter, but take that as an example. Why isn't someone doing it? You know, the players are trained from day one to play in a certain formation in a certain way, but innovation is what creates success in most parts of the world. I mean, they change tactics every 15 minutes, tactics formation every 15 minutes.
You look at Guardiola. Changes tactics during a game so often. And you can also see as well the whole, you know, the tiki-taka thing, which did work for a few seasons, came to an end, and counter-attacking football just blitzed it. I think Barcelona got a hammering, and then Bayern got a hammering. I think Bayern hammered Barca, and then I think it was Real Madrid that took Bayern apart. But, you know, you can see that Guardiola, you know, is evolving his tactics. It's still possession-based. But, the understanding of the tactics and what their jobs are. And that's, I mean, look at, for instance, Van Gaal. How much criticism is he getting from Manchester United fans for adhering to really, really rigid tactics? And tactics are the most important thing to him, and he's been pilloried for it.
Even Ferguson, defence aside, but offensively, would change tactics and formation 20 minutes, 30 minutes if it wasn't going his way.
Well, he would experiment. Bringing in Veron, you know, that was trying to evolve. It didn't work, but, you know, he was trying to at least evolve the team.
But someone like Tactics Tim, you know, Tim Sherwood, he got heavily criticised for always changing formations. But that's purely because he didn't know his players, and the players didn't know what he was.
Well, I
what
think
was being demanded.
You
of
always
them.
Felt with him it was a little bit like Brendan Rodgers, where it was just kind of guesswork. You know,
I'll just
keep trying a new formation until one works.
Yeah. I mean, this season, the only person that's really changed tactics and it has worked is Ranieri. As much as everyone did used to call him the Tinker Man, his team has been pretty much structured since day one of the season. However, when it hasn't worked, he's made some substantial changes at half time, and they've rescued the most points of anybody.
Top of the table.
Also, there was one game as well where he dropped Mahrez from the start. We're talking about, you know, you can't drop your best players. Well, he did, and
you need confidence. You need confidence in your alternatives. I mean, you know, you need intelligent players. If you could say to every player,
right,
we've got formation A. You play to that. Now, when I clip my fingers, you move to formation B. How many players could really adapt and play at the top of their game, you know, with two faces, two things? It's not there. Maybe that's the evolution of football. That's evolution. Yeah. Players can switch and be at their top of the game with both.
Because
the last thing a manager wants to do is switch, and then the player's only playing at 70% of his capability because he's a little bit unsure. It's too much of a risk. But if you can get your players in two modes or three modes, you'll be able to do that. But that's obviously hell of a lot of work.
We say that sat here as, you know, intelligent, probably reasonably well-educated people. You look at most of your common footballers. Do they actually have the mental capacity to learn three modes?
Well, it's interesting because there was something I listened to either earlier this week or last week, and it was saying that as football evolves, you will see more intelligent players, more and more coming to the fore, who understand that very point, Tom. So, yeah. Okay, well, as interesting as ever, or as interesting as part two ever gets, but it's a debate that will rumble on. Hopefully we've given you some food for thought. That will take us to the end of part two, and we'll be back with part three and the weekend previews. Okay, so so here we are back with part three of the Beyond the 90 podcast, powered by One Shot Football. You can get all your latest football news and views and analysis and everything else that you need at www.oneshotfootball.com. Now, in part three, we're here to preview some of the more interesting games of the weekend and, of course, our quiz, or my quiz, I should say. But anyway, we'll kick off at Villa Park with Villa Watford. One for the purists, this, I think, and one that will be without Jack Grealish, Ryan.
Yeah, well, I guess the new manager's trying to make his presence felt and discipline throughout the club.
Well, certainly it was quite telling, you know, in the 10th anniversary of George Best's death, that Jack Grealish was doing his best to impersonate certainly the off-field activities.
Maybe that's it. Look, you've got to stamp your authority on a club, of course, you get to as a manager, and he was out of line and needs to be punished.
Well, Sherwood had had several pops at him last season as well.
I don't think it makes a difference to Villa. I think they are the worst team in the division by a million miles, and we talk about this almost every week. I don't think the French contingent really helps an attitude of a club, and you can bag me for that if you want, but there's the sulk factor, and I think this will be another poor weekend for Villa, and I think Watford should seize the opportunity and make the 3 points theirs.
So you go for an away win then?
I will go for an away win. I don't think it'll be... I think it will be easy actually. 2-0.
Just going around the table. Tom, what are you thinking here?
I completely agree with that, especially Watford playing two up top against Villa, with Kieran Richardson now playing left back. It's just an invitation just to bomb on really there, because they lost the lad. As a Malvi, I forget his name.
First name will be Jordan, that's for sure. Yeah. As they all are.
lost him, and he looked quite a handy player. So I think Villa, they're really going to struggle. So I'll go for an away win, 2, maybe 3-0. But that's biased for my dream team.
Okay. Gazella?
I'll mix it up and say it'll be a draw, because Villa have got a new manager. They got a draw against City. Yes, they did get thrashed against Everton. But, you know, they might just play and contain Watford. Could happen.
I mean, he'll have had a little bit of time on the training pitch now, and I don't think Watford are all that either. I think they've had a decent start. I'm going for a home win, 1-0 to Villa. Okay, now Palace, Newcastle. So they've had some mixed results, some poor results. Palace, I mean, just need some consistency. I mean, they've had one draw, I think, all season. And Newcastle, well, they need goals, they need a better defence, they need maybe a new manager. I don't know what they need. Ryan, what's going on here?
This is all about Curbs, isn't it? He won't need any motivation. He is going to... I mean, because Palace are a good team. Mm-hmm. He is a man manager, and he gets the most out of that team. If he can't get them on top form for this game, I don't know what else he could do. I mean, for me, I think he's going to make it happen. I think Crystal Palace win this as well.
It was a poor result home to Sunderland, but I mean, it was a Scott Dan mistake. You know, I think it was an individual error.
I think it's 3-1 to Newcastle. 3-1 to Palace. Sorry, I think Newcastle struggle here. Crystal Palace got too much in the armoury department. I think Newcastle don't have enough to defend it.
Oh, there's definitely a few subplots here, and obviously Pardew, you know,
Caballé as well.
Yeah, Kabay obviously is a big subplot there, and also Newcastle have got no one in the middle of the park. Colback's now out injured for I think 6 weeks. I heard Tioti, I think, is either on a, I heard he was on a ban, or he's got a groin problem, so he's going to miss. And McLaren is not a good manager,
no.
In my personal opinion. I think this is definitely one for Pardew if he can keep his rage under control. I mean, as much as he wants the England job, so he's done well this season not to headbutt anybody. so if he can keep his rage under control, comfortable win for Palace.
I agree with that, absolutely. I think Pardew has a point to prove against Newcastle. They treated him really badly, I think. And I think Crystal Palace have got a lot of attacking threat that they can do some damage against Newcastle.
Yeah, I think Palace are a good team. I think so. Are we 4-4? Are we here?
Yeah, 3
home
points.
Win or run? Okay.
Not very often, that.
Now, I think we might get someone similar with the next fixture as well. Leicester at home to Manchester United. Jamie Vardy, it's in the stars. Ryan, what's happening here?
Am I able to take a Fifth Amendment on this one or not?
Do you know that actually this fixture took place, I think I heard it, it was 2001, 2002 took place.
Yes.
When Leicester were top of the league and Man United were second. And Manchester United thrashed them.
Well, obviously, it's obviously what I want to happen. I don't have a lot of confidence with United at the moment. Maybe being away from home might help them.
4-0 in 7 games. Lots of clean sheets.
Last season they were on the end of a pretty heavy result.
Well, this was the famous
5-3. 3-0 up.
I think if United treat Leicester like a club in at the top half of the table, United have got a chance. But a lot of people seem to be treating Leicester as a bottom club, you know, and if they treat them as a top six club and go out and play, maybe United have a chance.
What Leicester do though is leave gaps. They're attacking, they're fluid with their play, and maybe this is an opportunity for Man United to show their quality, stay calm, find those gaps, get in between them. I mean, look at their goals against for the team that's leading the Premiership. Is 20 goals this season.
Yeah, second highest goals conceded.
There you go.
So
that's what United need to pounce upon.
I mean, presumably a lot comes down to Van Gaal's team selection. You know, does he go with Mata or, you know...
Well, you're asking an impossible question when it comes to
Presumably he's going to persist with Rooney. And Martial seems to play if he's fit. So then it's really a case of whether...
Well, Mata will be fresher, presumably. He didn't play midweek, did he? So, Mata obviously has the touch, sees those gaps, runs forward...
Anyway.
It could be a surprise. Look, it could be a United win, which would be a surprise.
Well, but time to get off your fence.
Get off it, Ryan.
4-3 United. It's going to be a high-scoring game.
Okay.
I'll go for a Desmond 2-2.
Oh. Very good. No, I think Leicester are going to win this one. United have not been playing very well and kind of got away with it. And
that's kind of the story of their
season. They've kind of grinded out draws or just lost snatches at wins. But no, I think they're going to get found out. Leicester win.
Well, I think United have been strangling the life out of football. And I think they'll continue to do that on Saturday. So I'm taking United to win 1-0 in a miserable, just abject fixture, which just has everyone heading for the hills.
But do we think Vardy's going to score, though?
Well, if it's 1-0 to United, then no.
No. But in your 2-2, is Vardy going to score?
Oh, double.
Oh, right.
No, I think I might just leave the room as we talk about this next one. Spurs-Chelsea. Spurs have been absolutely superb. They lost on the opening day to United and haven't looked back. They were very, very good against West Ham. They're full of energy, and that's the last thing Chelsea need to be facing, I'm guessing, Tom.
I think Chelsea's probably only hope, really, is what we like to refer to in England as a Europa League hangover. Obviously, Spurs played all the way in Azerbaijan last night. It was 3,000 miles away from London.
I'm glad to see a very full Spurs team. Well done, Spurs, for taking that competition seriously.
They won 1-0, you know, but they had to work hard. They didn't score until the end of the game. And as you said, a very, very strong team. So maybe there'll be some tired legs, which could, you know, help Chelsea. But Chelsea could be buoyed, obviously, by their result in Israel on Tuesday. Obviously, they've had the extra time to recover. I'm going to go with a Chelsea win, to be honest.
Everyone keeps doing this every week and we keep losing. Everyone says this is the week they turn it around.
Well, Chelsea have won two games in a row, so this is obviously...
This is a rich vein of form.
Yeah, this is outstanding, right?
It's a rich vein of form you guys have found. Two games and one in a row in the Premier League. That's important.
All right, well, anyway, we have a Chelsea win from Tom. Gazella, what are you thinking?
Spurs are going to thrash Chelsea and it's going to be enjoyable. I can't wait to see it.
Is that dream team related?
No, it isn't actually. Which is kind of weird. Why would I want to cheer on Spurs? I mean, this is really weird. But I think Spurs are going to win.
Comfortable for Spurs for you, Ryan?
I agree with everything Tom said, and unfortunately, Steve, I'm going for a Chelsea win. 2-1.
Will and free kicks? You know,
well, he's the only player that's actually trying to win this. He's carrying the team, that Willen. Mm-hmm. He's a very good
player. He is. All right, now, Liverpool-Swansea. Sorry?
Oh, missed someone.
Yeah, missed someone out, did we? oh, God. I don't know what to say here. What I know is I would take a 1-1. Let's leave it at that. I would take a 1-1. All right, now Liverpool Swansea. Liverpool definitely looked to be improving under Klopp, but they did have a poor result at home against Palace. As we mentioned Gary Monk earlier, you know, this could be his last stand. I mean, Ryan, should this be a comfortable win for Liverpool? Or?
Yeah, Liverpool aren't on the finished article by any means, and obviously the Klopp regime.
Obviously played last night, home to Bordeaux.
Yeah.
Daniel Sturridge won't be fit, but I mean, that's not really news.
I think this is a game of confidence, and I think Liverpool have it and Swansea don't, and I think that's just as important sometimes in football as anything else. I'll go with that, and I don't think it'll be a great game. I think you'll have two tired teams, or it'll seem that way, but I'll go for a Liverpool win, probably something like 1-0. I just think it's confidence.
Yeah, I mean, they've not, under Klopp, they've not done it at home yet. I mean, after winning last week.
That's because all the fans keep leaving with 15 minutes to go, according to Jurgen Klopp. So.
I mean, he said he's not done it at home, and that's what he said they want to do after winning last weekend away. I don't know, I can see it being a tight game. Gary Monk's obviously maybe playing for his career, or you know, his team are playing for his career. If he picks a strong team, it's two sort of reasonably similar football ideologies. They both like to play nice passing football. I'm going to go for a draw, and probably a poor draw as well, 0-0.
Okay, Gazella?
I think Klopp in front of the cop is going to be very good and very exciting to watch. And they're on a real high right now, so I definitely think it's going to be a home win. 3 points for Liverpool.
Okay, I'll take Liverpool to win by the odd goal of 3-2-1. Now, Norwich Arsenal. Gazella, Arsenal were terrible, terrible against West Brom. It's the old Arsenal that we know. We get to the winter months, all the players lie down dead. You've lost Francis Coquelin for 12 weeks, the only holding midfielder. It was a great on goal from Mikel Arteta. I mean, just everything's looking wonderful. What's going on?
Everything that could go wrong did go wrong against West Brom, really. I mean, the fact that Coquelin is our only real DM.
And the goals were conceded after he went off.
Yeah, so he went off injured. He was subbed by Arteta. Arteta was only on the pitch for half an hour, scored an own goal, and then limped off injured, and he's out for a month. Arteta's out for 3 months.
Flamini come in?
Well, Flamini did quite well against Zagreb. He did.
I quite like Flamini, actually.
Yeah, but then the thing is he likes to be in front of the goal. He wants to be on the goal sheet. So is he defensively minded enough to have that job to fill Francis Coquelin's boots? I'm not quite sure.
Well, Wenger has said that he will spend in January, so presumably that will be on some young striker we've never heard of.
He'll speak French.
Yeah, he'll probably speak French. But
Wenger speaks five languages.
But I mean, Norwich, they didn't play badly against Chelsea, fairly well.
They nearly won, didn't they?
Well, I think they should have had a penalty in the first half. They probably count themselves a little bit unlucky, but they do seem to be lacking a bit of quality. I mean, Gazella, I mean, jokes aside, I'd expect Arsenal to get the points here.
Yeah, and we're on a run of very winnable fixtures, really. We should go to Norwich and get a win, and then we've got Sunderland at home, and then we've got the Olympiacos game. So I think we're on a, after the Zagreb win, we're back on again, because I think Arsenal, we had this terrible, terrible amount of luck against West Brom, and then we tend to respond really well with a big win. So that's what's happened with Zagreb, and Ozil just looks amazing right now. So I think it's definitely going to be
so away win for you.
Yeah,
I will. I'll go with an away win as well. Ryan?
No. This will be the archetypal seasonal Arsenal sulk, moody. It might be a bit windy at Norwich as well. It's getting a bit cold. There'll be people wearing gloves, pathetic things like that.
And long sleeve shirts, right?
Here's what's going to happen. Norwich will score an early goal. Then we'll get the Arsenal, you know, le shrug sulk. Mm. And you guys will be so lucky and score in the last 10 minutes just to rescue a draw that you didn't deserve. So 1-1 draw.
Norwich have got the boy Redmond. He looks very good. Could cause Arsenal problems. Although they do, Arsenal do have Ramsey back, and I think Oxlade-Chamberlain might be available this weekend as well, which gives them some pacey options. Again, though, I think it's going to be a draw. I think Norwich is quite a tough place to go. I think I'm going to go score draw.
Especially if Dealey has been on the sauce beforehand. So, okay, so two draws and two away wins we're predicting there. Okay, well, we're just going to round things off with our quiz. And this week we've seen all about the sublime talents of Barcelona's South American trio, Suarez, Messi and Neymar. So let's talk about some South American strikers in the Premier League. Possibly not quite hit the same heights. Now, Fulham signed a famous mask-wearing South American centre-forward. Can you name him?
Ruiz?
He pulled it out of his box, didn't he? It was only a few seasons ago.
I'll give you a clue.
Yeah.
It was Argentine.
Kept pulling it out of his pants.
I'm stuck with Ruiz in my head, I've got nothing else.
No. Facundo Sava.
I didn't know that.
He scored 6 goals in 27 league appearances, so the mask didn't really get much of an outing. Now, which South American is the highest scorer in the Premier League? Is it Gus Poyet, Carlos Tevez, Juan Pablo Angel, or Nobby Solano?
Going to go with Tevez.
Nobby Solano.
You're going with Tevez?
Tevez,
Solano. He's got a lot of free kicks.
He did, yeah.
With goals.
He played a long time.
Yeah,
so I'm going to go with Solano because he was around for quite
Tottenham,
a few years.
Newcastle.
Yeah.
But so was Tevez.
Sorry guys, that was a curveball. Gazzella gets the points. 77 goals for Carlos Tevez. Now, how much did Manchester City pay Blackburn for Rocky Santa Cruz?
32 million.
Not quite.
28.
I'm going to go about 18 million. I'm sure it's somewhere around that.
15.
Tom gets a point. 17.5 million. These are league appearances. Play 20 goals, 3. And Joe? Brazilian striker Joe?
Oh, yes, Joe, yes.
How much did they sign him for?
Over 10 million.
About 12? Definitely over 10. 12? Yes.
21.
21 there.
14.
14. Ryan gets the points. 19 million.
Ooh.
21 league appearances. Goals 1.
Robin a living.
Now, Manchester City. We'll continue with Manchester City. Under their new Abu Dhabi owners, who was their first marquee signing?
Rubinho.
September the 1st, that was their a deadline day signing.
It wasn't even that good.
Well, he played 41 league games for City. Could you tell me how many goals he scored?
Four.
12.
Only got 8. But did he score his debut?
I remember he scored a hat-trick against Chelsea. And I think he did.
He
did. Gazzella is the closest with 14. And you know, he's still only 31.
Really?
It's amazing as well.
We should sign him.
One of his Brazilian teammates was very critical of him when he signed, you know, leaving Real Madrid. It showed a lack of ambition. But in 5 years as a Chelsea player, how many league appearances did Hernan Crespo make?
Mostly as a sub. How many seasons?
5.
Did he really play for 5 seasons?
Well, he was a Chelsea player for 5 seasons.
34.
I'm going to go for 27.
50.
49, Gazzella gets the points.
Wow.
Well, he was loaned back to Italy to Inter and AC. He scored 20 goals. I don't actually ever remember him having a bad game for Chelsea. It was just that his family couldn't settle in London. But anyway.
Czech didn't have that problem.
No, thank you. Anyway, moving on. Now, in 1987, Newcastle signed a Brazilian striker who became the first Brazilian ever to play in the English League. What was his name? And I've seen him play. I saw him play against Scotland at Hampden in 1986, I think.
Is this the guy that did backflips? No, I'm thinking of the Colombian guy.
I might be too young to answer this question.
It might be too
young. I'm in the middle for a Janino before.
Tom, any ideas?
No, sorry, right. Northeast.
No.
Julio Jordio. No, that was a bloke from the Fast Show.
Yeah.
Remember Julio Jordio?
He was a brilliant character.
Anyway, no. His name was... that's one to look up on YouTube. His name was Mirandinha.
Mirandinha.
54 league appearances, 19 goals. Now, here's one for you, Gazella.
Oh,
2006,
yeah?
Arsenal signed which South American forward, nicknamed the Beast, on loan?
The Beast?
Good play. Signed him on loan from Real Madrid, who spent a fortune on him, buying him from, I think, it was either Celta Vigo or Deportivo, I think. Brazilian?
I want to say Eduardo, but I know that's wrong.
Nope.
So I have no idea.
No ideas from anyone?
Well, it rings a bell, but...
Big guy.
Oh,
you have an H?
The nickname The Beast is a clue.
Yeah,
I thought that, because Eduardo's not a beast.
He wasn't very good looking.
Well, I think his name begins with H, but I can't think why.
Julio Baptiste. Played 24, 3 goals. Now, this is a true story. Which British manager's son spotted Lionel Messi on Football Manager and urged his dad to sign him in 2001 when Messi was 13?
McLeish.
Alex McLeish.
It wasn't Darren Ferguson and Alex Ferguson.
His son John McLeish, who's actually now involved in football, said that he always played Football Manager and played as Barcelona and told his dad, this guy's going to be the best player in the world. And Alex McLeish said, yeah, all right, son, go away. Anyway. There you go, true story. Now, Arsenal's ex-Croatian striker, Eduardo, where was he born?
Yeah, he's South American.
I'm looking for the city, not just the country.
Sao Paulo.
The other one.
Rio.
Rio, yeah, there we go. Now, Liverpool signed Philip Coutinho from which club?
Inter
Milan.
And he was dirt cheap. Was it 8.5?
Oh, he's got part B as well.
Jeez.
Wow. Now, which club will they be selling him to this summer?
Real Madrid.
Barcelona's the answer, but anyway. anyway, Tom gets the points. Now, more a wide player than an attacker, but which Argentine player played a combined 347 league games in the last decade for Sunderland and Borough? Left-sided midfielder.
He's still playing there, isn't he? Sunday League. He turns out.
Well, that's part. He keeps. Oh, he's in.
Did you write the quiz, Tom?
Just remember seeing an article about.
It's Northern League Division 2. Yeah. That's part B of the question.
Wow.
Yeah.
But that's your specialty.
Yeah, Northern League. Northern
League. I'm gonna have to hurry you, because we're running out of time.
No.
Julio Arca.
I don't know the name of the team.
Can you name some dodgy northeast towns?
Whitley Bay.
No.
That's dodgy. Scunthorpe.
Begins with S.
Scarborough.
Begins with S. Double S.
South Shields.
There we go.
Got it.
Okay.
Geography question.
Well, that takes us to the end of today's Beyond the 90 podcast. I'm your host, Steve McBain. Thanks for listening. And Ryan Martin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you.
Tom, thank you very much. Hope you enjoyed your debut.
Thank you very much.
Gazella, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
We will be back next week. Thanks again for listening.